Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we wanted to work through a couple of related stories all around issues in healthcare, starting with what's been quite a big story for us here in the UK, that our relatively newish Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, Labour's Keir Starmer, has been kind of setting out his approach to the National Health Service, NHS. And his kind of top message has been, since really he won the election, but most recently in a speech he gave a few days ago, that the NHS is broken and simply pouring more money into it is not going to fix it. Have you been following this, Dad?
Yeah, you can't avoid it, can you? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that this is a peculiarity, I think, of the British political system, because I don't think there's another country in the world where health has anything like the political resonance in the UK. I mean, for sort of very complicated reasons, really, health has become intensely politicised. And I just think, you know, no other area really of it's hard to imagine another area, isn't it, in society in terms of services, which has this kind of political resonance. Whereas literally governments can fall on how the NHS is doing and whether they're on particular NHS scandals and so on. I mean, what's your take on that?
I mean, I remember reading an amusing, I think it was on Twitter, a thread of tweets by a French journalist who'd been working in London for a while. And she was kind of remarking at this very fact, you know, that, you know, she said, well, you know, in the country she's from, in France, they also have a healthcare system which people use just as much as they do in Britain. But she always says, but because it doesn't have a brand, it doesn't have a unified name, NHS, it doesn't have a single logo, it just doesn't have any of the political salience in the conversation. And people obviously care about the health system, but because it is a kind of mixed mode, partly insurance model, which is most common across most of the kind of developed world, she just says it doesn't loom in people's heads. You know, it's more like schools, you know, where you might have opinions about your particular local school and you might have some views about, you know, is the government recruiting enough teachers? But because there is no National Education Service, it doesn't grab the kind of, and doesn't, there's no focus for people's attention. And she was saying that's actually a bit healthier potentially. Whereas, as you say, people often talk about the NHS as kind of the unofficial state religion of the English people, that People talk about the care they received in kind of hallowed terms and the wonderful doctors and nurses, you know, when these are, you know, civil servants deploying a service for which they are remunerated in some cases quite handsomely for. But we don't talk about, you know, the wonderful bin men who collected our bins, who were so friendly and kind to us. And they didn't charge us at all.
Excuse me, I won't have anything said against the NHS angels. They're all angels.
Yeah, but then obviously I get it on one level, because it's not a service like any other. It's not like any other state-run service. It's, you know, when people are at their most vulnerable, or, you know, if you're a parent or kind of a loved one who's being receiving treatment, it's an intense period of time. And
But presumably that holds for the rest of Europe as well.
And yet they seem to be able to hold it in a bit more kind of cool detachment than, whereas we, for us, it's just kind of intense loathing or adoration and very little in between.
it's the political sensitivity there, because this is bringing memories back to me a very long time ago when I was sort of a fairly young and rather brash consultant. I had an incautious conversation with a journalist about the shortage of neonatal intensive care cots and problems with service delivery in neonatology, and I had this intense sinking feeling when walking out of the underground at Warren Street and seeing, in those days they had banner headlines, and there was the banner headline which was a front page article based on, I think it was the Daily Express, based on this incautious conversation. And the next thing that happens, I arrive at my desk to discover that the communications department of the trust is...
We'd like to speak to you rather urgently.
Rather urgently, yes. And then I get a conversation that's not so much cross, John, as disappointed. We've been in touch with number 10, and
that's 10 Downing Street, i.e. the Prime Minister.
Exactly. Steps are being taken and a rebuttal is going to be produced. And I was just reflecting on the fact that one sort of consultant, amongst thousands and thousands, could make an incautious comment to the journalist, which was now creating waves in 10 Downing Street.
Yeah.
And of course it all goes down, but it just shows you the sort of politicization of the health.
Yeah. And as you say, it is when pollsters ask people, what's the most important issue you want the government to be focusing on, health is invariably in the top three. So this is, so Keir Starmer very keenly knows, as an astute politician, that how he handled the NHS, which is kind of widely believed and seen by the public to be facing perhaps the worst crisis of its 70 plus year existence, is going to be going to go a long way to determine whether he wins the next election in 5 years time. So there's a high stakes for politicians when they kind of set out their stall like this.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, it does seem almost intractable, doesn't it? I mean, it seems, we've seen phrases like this, over the last 20, 30 years, haven't we, from politicians, I'm going to reform the NHS, it's broken, we have a plan, we're going to make it all better. And it is a massively complex phenomenon, isn't it? One of the world's biggest employees, with we think over a million people employed by the NHS.
Yes. And what is fascinating to me is there's a very clear shift in tone since the Labour government came to power. I mean, you might remember Wes Streeting, who's the new health secretary, on his literal first day in the job, as he walks into the health department, says, this government's policy begins with the fact that the NHS is broken. And he said, he was stunned by the failings he's discovered since he kind of had his briefings from the civil servants. And obviously this is party politics. This is about trying to blame the previous Tory government for the difficulties. But I think there is a real sense in which the kind of conservatives' approach was to try and dampen down suggestions of crisis and be like, okay, it needs some tweaking here, but let's just keep things ticking along. Whereas Labour is doing the opposite approach and saying, no, it's absolutely broken. It's in crisis. We need a 10-year recovery plan to try and get the system back up on its feet again.
Yeah. But politically, it's not, their honeymoon period isn't going to last that long, isn't it? Before people say, you've been in power now for 18 months, 2 years, and the NHS is still broken. So what are you doing? Why isn't it any better?
Yeah. And in this speech, we're talking about Keir Starmer kind of laid out his big plan. His kind of key theme was, we're not just going to, keep pouring more and more money in until we fix the system. The line here is, we have to fix the plumbing before we turn on the taps. So hear me when I say this, no more money without reform. And he said the big three shifts in the approach would be using more technology to try and create a digital NHS, shifting more care out of hospitals and into the community, and also moving from treating sickness to focusing on prevention.
Yeah, and I think all three of those make a lot of sense at a very high level. I think Starmer is definitely positioning himself and his government as a sort of classic technocratic government, aren't they? But, you know, we don't come with clear ideological
baggage. Yeah,
absolutely. We're just interested in
good delivery, and
we listen to experts. Yeah. We find the best technocratic solutions, and we implement them. Yeah. And Lord Darzi has produced this big report, which Starmer's plan is based.
Yeah. So Lord Darzi is a doctor who is also a member of the House of Lords, and he was commissioned by the Labour government to kind of write this summary of what's gone wrong, and that's going to kind of form the basis of their reform plans. But I guess in some ways, at least to me, who's not a health journalist, this feels like stuff we've heard a lot before. I mean, everyone since the kind of new Labour era 20 years ago has been banging on about trying to introduce more technology to cut costs and, you know, make the NHS go paperless and all this, and with very minimal success so far. And everyone agrees that we need to do more care in the community and in primary care and outside of the hospital context. And everyone agrees that we should be focusing on prevention rather than simply cures. You know, it feels like everyone can outline what has to happen. What is proved so intractable is actually making any of these changes last on the ground.
Yeah, and it is an extraordinarily complex business, isn't it? And unpicking it all, it is impossible. I think, you know, the very fundamental things are affecting health services across the world. This isn't unique to the UK. You know, it has much less political resonance elsewhere, but the same kind of issues of an aging population, chronic diseases. You know, the average person, they get into their 70s, has something like 5 or 6 chronic conditions, all requiring treatment. So that when you aim to provide a health service which deals with absolutely everything, whatever is required from birth until death, given the fact that we have an aging population with multiple pathologies, and at the same time more and more new and expensive treatments coming along, it's all very well to say, oh, so we're going to concentrate on prevention, but actually you can't, because there are an awful lot of diseases and people who need treating.
Yeah. And that's the kind of terrible irony, which is that as medical science makes extraordinary progress in terms of what we can treat people for and how we can keep people alive in the face of conditions that would have, slain people in their millions not so long ago, but all of this comes at ever-increasing costs. And the kind of dream of the NHS founders, which is that if we properly get everyone healthy, then actually the NHS cost will fall, has been proven to be quite the opposite, that the cost of providing healthcare, even if the population wasn't growing, goes up every year because there are more and more things we can do. Whereas, you know, when you were starting working as a doctor, if people got certain conditions, we just pat them on the head and gave them some painkillers and said have a good journey to the other side, whereas today they would go on a multi-month, maybe multi-year program of complex, expensive treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I could give many examples of that. When I was a junior doctor, the only treatment for an acute cardiac heart attack, myocardial infarction, where a blood clot in a coronary artery, a bit of heart muscle that's dying, The treatment is bed rest and sedation. And my memory was it was often 2 weeks bed rest followed by very slow mobilization. That was all you could do. Now it's an acute medical emergency, because if you can get the patient into a cardiac center within minutes or at most an hour or two, you can do a sophisticated procedure to remove the clot out of the coronary artery and prevent any permanent heart damage. But, you know, so it's completely changed. and you
which is wonderful, lots of lives are saved. But then these people, you know, require more and more resources. And as we talked before in the podcast, you know, the whole principle of both insurance systems and of an NHS, of a state run system, is that you get the healthy people to pay for the sick. And that's why insurance companies need as many healthy people who never claim to cover the extreme high costs of the poor people, but of the ill people. In the same way, we need young, fit, healthy working people to pay their taxes and start businesses and grow the business and be economically successful to pay in taxes to cover the costs of the elderly. But we're actually having the opposite. We're in a massive demographic transition in which the number of elderly people who are pensioners and retired and are contributing very little in tax revenue is going up and up, just as the point at which we need more and more young people to pay for their ever-increasing health bills.
So this is all very depressing and Malthusian, isn't it? I mean, so where's the good news? Is it possible that technology is going to help? I think absolutely yes. You know, I think I said this before, contrasting the way that online shopping, we're like the big online shopping operates so extraordinarily in such a sophisticated and accurate way, and the inefficiency in the way that information is transferred across the NHS does make me think that if it was possible to use the same kind of technological approaches for the plumbing of the NHS, we could see very substantial improvements. That's one kind of level. Another level, which I think is genuinely going to make a difference, and that is, it's already being introduced in some places in the States, where all the conversations between the health, like the doctor, the nurse, the practitioner, and the patient, is recorded and transcribed instantaneously by AI, so that the doctor doesn't need to make any kind of notes during the consultation. They doesn't need to. They simply talk. And it is then transcribed and then analysed, and the necessary letters and so on are all generated. Hmm. And clinicians say this is transformative, because it means now that in the consultation, spending the whole time staring at a screen and then trying to capture it all, I can actually talk and listen. And and the patient also receives a transcript of all that was said. So you can see some forms of technology like that can actually make a significant difference, so that the health practitioners spend less time doing admin and repetitive tasks and more time doing the stuff which they're good at and which they are paid for.
Yeah, and you can definitely see there is huge scope for improvement. I mean, NHS is kind of famously quite old-fashioned when it comes to technology. They only managed to phase out pagers and fax machines in literally the last few years. For a long time, the NHS was one of the only customers who were still paying Windows to provide support for their Windows, Microsoft Windows XP software, because they still had hundreds of thousands of computers running XP for several years after Windows had kind of officially deprecated the software and abandoned it. Yeah. So it's a very backwards institution. So you can certainly see there's huge scope for efficiencies and trimming costs through technology. I guess, and it's fair to say that lots of the people in Silicon Valley are lots of the famous, there are lots of startups, but even some of the big famous existing tech companies, your Amazons, Facebooks, Googles, are pouring a large quantities of investment into building out kind of nascent health branches of their businesses, and in large part because health is an extraordinarily big business in the States, isn't it? You know, it accounts for something crazy like 19% of GDP is health spending in certain ways. So there's a huge slice of the pie that these companies are eyeing up if they can muscle in on.
That's right, and of course it's a vast market as well, with, you know, 300 million patients or whatever. So I think what I suspect is going to happen, and of course nobody has a crystal ball, is that new technological health solutions are going to be developed by the big American tech companies. They're going to be implemented within America, and the problems ironed out. And once it is demonstrated that this actually saves money, they will come looking across the rest of the world. And I think our blithe assumption that it'll never work in the UK and they'll never fix the NHS, I think that actually will turn out not to be the case. But the danger, of course, is that we can lose a lot. I mean, the analogy, of course, is how Amazon and the other online shoppers have completely obliterated so many local shops, local bookshops, local...
Or even state institutions, Royal Mail, you know, yep. Been eaten for lunch, lost a lot of its parcel business, you know. So is the same going to happen to the NHS? You know, are we... And that is a huge political kind of culture war flashpoint in British political debate, isn't it? You know, people are constantly levying accusations at the Conservative Party that they want to privatise the system on the sly. They want to sell it off to American vulture capitalists and sometimes more kind of populist left-leaning politicians kind of like to tub-thump about how we're going to stand up against these rapacious capitalists and stand up for our different socialist model of healthcare. And I guess that feeds into this sense that a lot of people have, which is that American healthcare is a kind of rapacious wild west in which the poor are left to fend for themselves while the rich get ever more expensive and esoteric treatment at the drop of a hat. And we cherish our NHS for all its flaws and manifold failings, as we've gone over in this podcast. It's still free at the point of use to every citizen, irrespective of your status. And that's something to be cherished and fought for. Do you share that kind of sense? That, because lots of Christian doctors would make that case quite strongly, that, you know, there's almost something Christian about how we've organized our healthcare in comparison to the kind of more capitalist model in America.
Yes, I think there's a lot of caricature about the American system, because, I mean, the reality now is with various versions of Obamacare and Medicaid and Medicare and so on, actually socialized healthcare is a very significant part of American healthcare now. So it isn't, you know, the caricature of these rapacious private hospitals and ambulance chasers and so on. I think is pretty far from
checking your insurance card before we start resuscitating your heart.
It's pretty far from reality, from what I see of American healthcare. But I think that there is no fundamental biblical theological reasons why healthcare can't be organized in many different ways. I do think the Christian focus is always on widows and orphans and immigrants, and therefore we ask of any health system from a Christian perspective, how does it treat the most vulnerable, the most the people who have no resources? And I think, you know, historically the NHS has done pretty well. I do think that we are going to see, and I would actually welcome it, an increased amount of charging and making a contribution for NHS service. I mean, we accepted that on drugs, outpatient drugs, long ago.
Or even dentistry, for some reason I don't understand. You have to pay for your dentistry on the NHS.
So, you know, if one had to pay £5 to go to visit a GP and £15 to go to the A&E, but that was means tested, and, you know, I
you
think
could claim it back if it caused you financial distress or you were a regular patient or something like that.
And I think that creates a kind of disincentive of abuse and allows people who are wealthy to contribute more to the cost of their care, without completely destroying the fundamentals of the idea of the safety net that's available for everybody. So I suspect that that's coming, and I also think that a big issue there, which we haven't yet touched on and I think is absolutely central, is that the NHS doesn't operate in isolation. It is basically affected hugely by what's going on in society as a whole, and in particularly the fact that social care is broken and the fact that there isn't proper provision for dependent and vulnerable elderly people means that many patients spend days, weeks, or even longer in wards simply because it's not safe for them to be discharged into the community. And until a government is prepared to tackle that Gordian knot about social care within the community, they simply are not going to be able to solve the majority of the problems of the NHS. It's a seamless web, and yet, for historical reasons, they're funded totally differently, aren't they?
Yeah, so what limited kind of state funding for social care in the community comes through local councils in Britain, which get some of their funding from central government and taxation and some of it from kind of local council taxation, but never enough, basically. And so it's a very patchy model, and I'm not an expert, but I think there are some degrees of means testing involved. And if you really can't afford kind of, you know, social care as you get older, you can get the council to pay some of your fees, or historically they were even kind of council run kind of old people's homes. But it, again, costs in the health sector are also rocketing up as people live longer with more chronic conditions. And it's been widely acknowledged for a long time across the parties, really, that the kind of care system we have is broken. It doesn't work. Another system that's broken. But for 20 years or so, governments have been coming up with ideas and then finding it politically imprudent to pursue them, and so kicking it into the long grass. And we've had the latest example actually just after the election. The very same government, Keir Starmer's government, announced in a need to try and save money from a supposed black hole in the government finances they discovered left behind, they've scrapped a small tweak which would have seen a kind of cap placed on your total care costs, which has been a long-standing kind of effort to try and introduce, and it was just announced kind of a few years ago, and before it even comes into force, it's been scrapped.
And this is one of the frustrations of democratic politics, isn't it? That because of the electoral cycle, there's this huge temptation for politicians to kick these kind of problems into the long grass. They're simply too difficult. And so government after government, parliament after parliament, these critical issues are never really tackled. Mm. You know, I perhaps naively think some kind of element of national unity, instead of, because everybody's on the same side here, everybody wants to see it fixed. Why let party politics destroy all this? Mm. Can't we have some kind of something which goes beyond party politics and which we will all agree to find a consensus, rather than have this constantly yabu, well, it was the other side that wrecked it, and now we're doing our best, and now, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And there are, you know, day-to-day kind of spending pressures on governments from all sorts of areas. And so the temptation is always to divert money to other things, because you could spend £10 billion on the NHS and it might not reap the reward for 10 years, in which case you'll be out of politics. And so you won't see the electoral benefit, but I could give people money in their pocket right now by using that same funds to cut, you know, VAT or something. And so I think that there's one of the huge drawbacks of the system that we have, which is unusually for a kind of developed world, incredibly top down and centralized, is that it gives enormous levers to pull for a bunch of elected politicians who cycle through fairly regularly, who aren't health policy experts themselves, whereas more kind of dispersed systems are actually more technocratic because they're run by professional health managers and they're not at the whims, as you say, of kind of shifting electoral democracy.
Did you know that this month marks the fourth anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. So that's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, so I wonder whether we should pivot at this point to say, is there any other prospect for improving the health of the nation? And is it possible that technology could actually take some of the strain off health services rather than inexorably increasing year on year?
Well, funny you should ask that question, Dad. Funny you should ask the question, because there is an interesting, which we've discussed on this podcast before, but a new range of so-called wonder drugs coming online as we speak over the last year or two, which a lot of people have got very excited about, having huge dent on one of the most chronic health problems of the 21st century, which is obesity. We've discussed these obesity drugs before. Do you want to very briefly remind us what they are?
Yeah, so it's all based on a sort of new understanding of the way that reward mechanisms work within the brain, and in particular receptors called the GLP-1.
Glucagon-like peptides?
That's right,
that right,
very good. I'm impressed, Tim. It's an educational business being up. So...
I don't know what a glucagon-like peptide is, but I can say the name.
Well, quite. You don't need to know what it is. Sounds good. So, but anyway, when we are doing an activity which is rewarding, we like eating too much, this activates these GLP-1 receptors. That's fundamentally the mechanism that's going on in our heads. And we keep eating until those receptors are full, are all activated. Whereas if you have a drug which activates those receptors, you lose your hunger. You lose this craving because those receptors are now all activated anyway. And so this is a group of drugs which are sweeping across the world in an extraordinary way. And so much so that this small group of pharmaceutical companies that pioneered these drugs are becoming immensely wealthy, and lots of other pharmaceutical companies are jumping on the bandwagon. Now, we tackled this previously, didn't we, Tim? So for those that are interested, we could go back and reference a previous
podcast. I'll put a link to the last episode we did on the drugs. But I guess moving away from the kind of direct questions around, which are very interesting, around, you know, how we view obesity. Is it primarily a biological issue or a kind of moral failing? And, you know, I think that there is, what is clear is that there is a lot of people in the technology and healthcare sectors who are kind of jumping on this as a potential, you know, I called it a wonder drug, but it might have kind of wonderful effects in terms of not just being good for people who are obese and are no longer obese, but it might have these huge knock-on effects on public health more generally, creating more capacity in healthcare services to look after other things. But also, we know that obesity has loads and loads of side effects around things like diabetes or even dementia and cardiovascular health. So there is kind of excitement brewing that if we can finally make enough of these GLP-1s, these drugs, because we can't currently meet demand anywhere close, we could not only cut back on obesity, but maybe have this kind of virtuous cycle in lots of other areas as well. Do you buy into that?
Well, the numbers are absolutely mind-boggling. So if you just in the US alone, the numbers are 140 million people with obesity, 122 million people with cardiovascular disease, 38 million people with diabetes, 53 million people with arthritis, chronic kidney disease, and so it goes on. And the theory is that if you can fundamentally tackle obesity, you are going to have a knock-on effect in reducing all of these other conditions, all of which have massive health effects and lead to very significant health spend. So yes, you end up spending a lot of money on the drugs, but the net effect is that you spend less on healthcare as a whole. Hmm. And but also, I mean, for instance, apparently Walmart are reporting that people on these drugs spend less on their weekly food shops. Restaurant takings are reduced. And so, you know, all of a sudden, there's a kind of unanticipated knock-on consequences if you suddenly change the eating habits of millions of Americans.
Hmm. And there is, while the effect of these drugs on obesity has been kind of established in a series of well kind of organized and controlled trials, there are some emerging suggestions, still a bit more tentative, that they might have some other interesting effects in terms of reducing not just cravings for food, but potentially cravings for alcohol or even compulsive shopping and other addictive kind of socially harmful activity. And so some people are saying, well, hang on, could we be starting to be emerging into an era in which we can start to control lots of kind of negative side effects of being human through pharmacology?
So there is quite a lot of evidence that very similar mechanisms within the brain, reward mechanisms, operate in lots of other addictive behaviour. And therefore, if these drugs are actually operating at the level of the appetite for food and reducing appetite for food, the craving for food, is it possible that they will reduce craving for other addictive substances? And there is, as you say, accumulating evidence that it does, at least for some people, it reduces craving for alcohol, for drugs of addiction, for smoking, and even in one case, retail shopping. And actually, I don't think it's totally unlikely, given I think we're all aware of that fact. When we get a sort of overwhelming craving for something, which we know deep down we don't really need, it isn't essential to our survival, and yet that sense of craving drives our behavior, and therefore a drug which reduced that sense of craving could have very positive effects.
Yeah. I guess my response to this, as it often is one of slight cynicism and or skepticism, in that, and when we mentioned on the last time we talked about this, that what is not yet clear, because they're so new, is what the potential long-term side effects of being on these GLP-1 drugs could be. And a kind of basic rule of thumb in medicine is that the more powerful an effect a drug has doing the thing we want it to do, the more likely it will have quite powerful side effects. I would just have a note of caution that, I don't think there's ever been a kind of wonder drug that we can just stick millions of people on for the long term and it has no side effects or unintended consequences. That hasn't been found thus far, and I would be very surprised if these drugs turn out to be the first ever drugs that we can just medicate a whole nation on without worrying about unintended side effects.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think, I mean, already there have been reports of, you know, some rare side effects and so on. There's no doubt the more these drugs get used, the more that side effects will come out. But that doesn't mean that you have to balance benefit against side effects, risks of harm. And the idea of harm minimization, that these drugs are not perfect, nonetheless are significantly reducing the harm that people are doing to themselves through overeating, I think is very interesting. I mean, part of me thinks it's the classic thing, isn't it? Is that we have here a problem which is created in large consequence by technology, by ultra-processed foods, by the whole advertising desire, you know, desire generation. The whole purpose behind advertising is to make you have a sense of desire something you didn't know you needed. And so we've got all this technology creating desire enhancement. And that, what's the solution? Well, we've got some other bit of technology which just reduces the effect on the brain. You know, and you think, really?
And the fact that it happens to make some executives at big pharma companies staggeringly wealthy is a plucky side effect. I think the other question I would have is, do we want to be a society in which we say we can't change the kind of harmful patterns that we go down, so we'll just medicate them away, even if they did work superbly? I can see why it's attractive to a kind of health policy civil servant trying to minimize, the cost of the NHS's like anti-obesity services. Sure, great, like that works for them really well. But as Christians, we ultimately think, there are obviously biological roots to some of our bad choices and our destructive, harmful behavior. our compulsions, our addictions, but there are also moral, spiritual underpinnings, and no drug is going to be able to solve the problem of the human heart, which is a spiritual, not a biological one. So I do wonder whether we, as Christians in particular, should be quite cautious about the kind of enthusiasm people are saying, it's fine, we're going to abolish not just obesity, but we'll get rid of smoking and alcohol and domestic violence and all these other things just through taking a pill every day. What's the problem?
Yeah, and it's a really interesting, and I think to some extent, quite a new philosophical, theological issue, isn't it? Question. Because, you know, let's just suppose that it does turn out, you know, that in 5-10 years' time, that taking this drug really does have a substantial effect in reducing addictive behaviours of all kinds and makes people less liable to violence because they're not, you know, craving drugs and whatever. What would the response be from a Christian point of view to saying we should make this widely available? The argument is we are body, soul and spirit. We're an embodied being, and therefore what's going on in our bodies affects us morally and spiritually. And if we found something that helps us behave in a more moral way, is that necessarily a wrong thing for us to do? I think it just raises interesting issues, and this I predict this is going to be a growing trend generally in pharmacology. You know, the idea of moral enhancement, we're going to make people more moral, more cooperative, less violent, less hate-filled, and the way we're going to do it is in some kind of brain modification, either by drugs or by other forms of stimuli. And I feel very much in two minds. On the one hand, I can see the positive argument in terms of harm minimization, but there is something about the control of the human which demeans our fundamental humanity, when we are basically zombies being, that is the extreme, controlled by pharmaceutical companies.
Hmm. You know, and some people often say, you know, the key distinction between humans and, you know, other created beings, angels, whatever, is that God uniquely gave us the ability to choose whether he wanted to live his way, to choose whether he wanted to live in harmful or loving ways. And, you know, if we can be reduced to kind of perfect moral beings because we are drugged up to our eyeballs, is that really part of the plan? I mean, it makes me think of, I think fundamentally my caution here is that I think the anthropology, the worldview of Christians is very different to the worldview of the people producing these drugs, and that they think, you know, humans do bad stuff because their brains are faulty, and if we can fix the brain, we can stop the bad stuff happening. But Jesus says, you know, why, you know, it's not what is unclean on the outside, you know, it's what makes you unclean comes from the human heart. It's not eating bad stuff or whatever that makes you that makes you sinful. It's the fact that we're broken on the inside. And that's the whole kind of Christian story, is about the fact that we can't fix through external means. We needed this kind of spiritual heart transplant on the cross. And I think if we lose sight of that in this kind of misguided drive to try and medicate ourselves to morality, something quite serious will be lost from the fundamentals of the Christian faith.
Yeah, I fundamentally agree with that, and I don't think I'm saying that. But what I am saying is that we do know that addiction, particularly chemical addiction, is a very real phenomenon. If you think about somebody who is an established alcoholic, and who simply, you know, it is not possible for them to live without taking, you know, huge amounts of alcohol every day. That person can be a genuine believing Christian and someone open to the Holy Spirit and all the rest. In fact, I know people like that who nonetheless have been completely trapped by alcoholism. And they also know that until this chemical addiction has been treated, it's not possible for them to exercise the kind of self-control that a Christian ought to do, and therefore, you know, providing medical treatment that overcomes the addiction is an essential part of Christian care. It's not the only part, but until you've solved the addiction, you can't do the other stuff. And I suppose so that's the analogy, isn't it?
Yeah.
If these drugs are providing medical, and certainly if you think of people with morbid obesity, of whom there are a huge number, particularly in the States, but quite a lot here too, the idea that there is some kind of addictive process there, that even though they would like to control their eating, they can't, and that we've found a way of delivering them from that addictive process, I don't think that's necessarily runs against what you said earlier, that ultimately there is a spiritual component as well.
Yeah. And I think, in addition, I think we can't be kind of blind, as much as we want to focus on the kind of individual personal character issues, as particularly as evangelicals, I think we can't be blind to, as you talked about, the widow, orphan and stranger, and fundamentally the NHS is crippling under the weight of trying to treat chronic health conditions. And if, you know, all our resources as a society are poured into treating, you know, diabetes and cardiovascular issues and these kind of things and dementia, we're not able to provide the proper care for widows, orphans and strangers that I think is quite biblical. And whether that can be delivered through the state and the taxpayer or through a private system, you know, that's up for debate. But fundamentally, as a nation, we do need to come up with solutions to kind of liberate our healthcare resources so that we can be directed towards the kind of really critical kind of compassion-driven objectives that healthcare should be centered on. And so I think we can't be glib about dismissing things that might be kind of reduce our enable us to redirect resources in a more kind of classically compassionate healthcare driven way, you know, treating the fundamental kind of sicknesses and brokenness of the world that no one, you know, when someone gets cancer, it's nothing they've done in many instances. It's just because we live in a broken planet crippled by the fall. And this is part of our job is to help people through that brokenness through the miracles of modern medicine. So I think there's certainly a Christian argument from that side as well.
Yeah, well, we probably ought to draw these things to a close, but my prediction, and for what it's worth, is that these GLP-1 drugs are going to turn out to have a dramatic impact, not just in the States, but across the world, and that they will, on balance, have, you know, all sorts of ramifications. But I think they are a way forward of solving some of the problems of excess consumption and some of the really damaging addictions which so many of us are prone to.
Well, if we're doing predictions, I would say I think they will prove to be an interesting new tool in the armory for treating obesity, but will be unlikely to have sweeping societal ramifications. But that's the great thing about predictions, that we won't know for about 5 to 20 years, so no one will ever put us up on it, whatever happens.
Watch this space.
Yeah, if Molad's still going in the 2060s, we can reconvene and see who was right and wrong.
It'll be called Matters of Aging Life and Impending Death.
Yeah, very true. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. If you've got suggestions or disagreements, please do get in touch with us. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. Lots of our episode ideas come from suggestions emailed in by listeners, so please do get in touch if you see something interesting, or even if you want to disagree with what we've been talking about, we really welcome the discussion. There's lots of interesting resources on Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, and you can follow some of my journalism at tswyatt.com as well. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.